calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Fifty-two percent. That's the percentage of Americans who think Congress should consider impeaching George W. Bush if he wiretapped U.S. citizens without court approval, according to a new Zogby poll. This is the second poll to come up with similar numbers. More than half of Americans disagree with Richard Nixon when he said to David Frost, lo, these many years ago...
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
Yeah. No, actually. No. So, in fact, it's interesting. The Moonies, Reverend Moon, you know, owns the Washington Times, which is the only newspaper that George Walker Bush will read on those rare occasions when he does read a newspaper. And the Reverend Moon also owns a website, Inside Magazine, InsideMag.com, the website. And his online magazine is talking about, has this interesting article, impeachment hearings, the White House prepares for the worst, that the White House is preparing for impeachment. This from Insight Magazine. The Bush administration is bracing for impeachment hearings in Congress. A coalition in Congress is being formed to support impeachment, an administration source said. Sources said a prelude to the impeachment process could begin with hearings by the Senate Judiciary Committee in February. And that could even be, you know, what is starting with our own inspector. Congressman John Conyers is with us, John Conyers of Michigan. Congressman Conyers, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Greetings and salutations. Great to be with you.
Thank you. It is always so wonderful to have you on our program, sir. You are holding hearings or have been holding hearings on some of these issues that may end up being issues around impeachment, I understand, in the basement of the Capitol?
It's quite possible that these are questions that could rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors in terms of the conduct of the President of the United States. And, you know, it goes back, Tom, to the Downing Street memos hearing that I held in the basement as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
in which we got the clearest indication that a war policy, a war against Iraq, was in the making, and they were in the process of conforming the facts to accommodate the policy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty serious when you're told that by high officials in Washington, and you are the chief of the intelligence unit for the British government.
Yes. Yeah, I would think so. Now, Richard Nixon went to his grave suggesting that Article 2 of the Articles of Impeachment that were drafted against him, and I believe you were in Congress at that time, were you not?
I introduced the first impeachment articles against a sitting president in 150 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, Bella Abzug was on them.
Yep.
Ron Dellums,
mm-hmm,
was on it. Shirley Chisholm was on it.
Some
William Fitzryan of New York was on it.
Now, Richard Nixon, right up to his last days, here's his comment to David Frost. He said,
"Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
When the president does it, that means it's not illegal." This is the argument now that Gonzalez and Bush are making about illegal wiretapping.
Right. The president has conceded that if you don't understand how he operates, you would think that this is that his domestic wiretapping without warrants is illegal because he has deemed, even though it's against the law, and even though we created the FISA law to accommodate domestic wiretaps, even though there have only been four turned down in the course of the whole existence of the foreign intelligence surveillance courts, even though the head of the courts has resigned in disgust about this. He says, look, I reserve this to myself because I am the commander-in-chief. Well, he's the commander-in-chief of the military. He's not the commander-in-chief of secret intelligence.
Or of the United States.
Or of the United States.
Yeah.
So what we have here, to me, and I think the reason that they are tackling it with such aggressiveness is that we're not now talking about constitutional niceties, as important as they are, that this is a tripartite government. What we're doing now is telling people that your phone could be tapped by the President of the United States direction, anybody, everybody, no exclusions, and he says that regardless of what the law says on this, he is the last word. Precisely what Nixon, as you point out, said all the way to his grave.
We're talking with Congressman John Conyers of Michigan. Congressman Conyers, the Reverend Moon owns the Washington Times, the newspaper there in Washington, D.C., which is the only newspaper George W. Bush says he'll read. Reverend Moon also owns Insight Magazine, which has just run an article suggesting that the hearings that Arlen Specter is going to hold starting in February about the FISA Act and the Bush administration are actually being perceived by people inside the White House as the prelude to an impeachment hearing. And in fact, they write in Insight Magazine, sources said the probe to determine whether the president violated the law will include Republicans, but that they may not be aware that they could be helping to lay the groundwork for a Democratic impeachment campaign against Mr. Bush. And but apparently the folks in the White House are taking this very seriously.
The Washington Times said that.
No, this is Insight Magazine, which is also owned by Reverend Moon. Insightmag.org .com is their website, they're, you know, it's basically another arm of
sure.
the Moon Empire, the Moon political empire, shall we say. And I'm wondering if you think that it is conceivable that Arlen Specter could get his back up enough about this that he would take on George W. Bush even in the absence of a Democratic majority in the House or Senate.
Well, the fact that I probably don't think that he will, he could still be unwittingly moving us toward these considerations of whether a high crime or misdemeanor has occurred. You see, nobody has been talking about the I word. It's been dealt with very secretly, off the record. Nobody wanted to say anything. But I was stunned a couple weeks ago when I read in the paper that Senator Specter said, well, I don't think that some particular thing under discussion with the news media would lead to impeachment. In other words, let's face it, Tom, it's in the back of everybody's mind,
yeah.
No matter whether you're a conservative or a liberal or something in between.
Or a member of the White House staff, apparently.
Yeah, so now the hearings, the ad hoc hearings that I held only last Friday, seems like longer than that, the ones in which I brought in some fabulous experts and law professors and the American Civil Liberties Union Washington director. And then, of course, a victim in Florida, a senior citizen who was in a very innocent organization that found out he was being wiretapped. The discussion was so brilliant and so insightful that you can't get this out of your mind in regular discussions among people in the Congress. People are beginning to say, you know, if the president started a secret war, that's probably impeachable.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
people are beginning to say, if the president has been spying on people contrary to the Supreme Court interpretations, the statutory provisions, not only of FISA, but the powers we gave him to additional military powers to go into Afghanistan, there was nobody that ever thought for a second that there were that they were giving him a license to wiretap or surveil Americans inside the United States. So it's all this constant barrage of misstatements and mistruths are beginning to catch up with him. We're linked. My webpage is linked to Henry Waxman's webpage, which has brought forward a very interesting study. The president has made 57 misstatements, falsehoods, or exaggerations about the war in Iraq, and the next person closest to him is the vice president of the United States, who's made 51. Now we've got a problem here, and the problem is that we don't know what the truth of the matter is, because they've never responded to us, to the 540,000 citizens that joined us asking the president, please answer some simple questions about the Downing Street memo hearings.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're saying is that we've got two things to do. One, let's start a select committee like Sam Irwin's, House Resolution 535, in which we set up a committee, not going to a regular committee where they've got the numbers stacked against us, but evenly, an even number of D's, an even number of R's. The vice chairman would be a Democrat. They'd be named by Pelosi, and Speaker Hastert would name the Republicans, but the vice chairman would have subpoena power as well as the chairman. And then let's have a hearing where we could subpoena in the documents and the people that we need to put flesh on to this 237-page report of that I called the Constitution in Crisis that these gentlemen have brought on.
This is marvelous what you're doing. Congressman John Conyers, we have less than a minute left. I'm wondering, what can our listeners do to support you? What is your website? It's johnconyers.com, right?
Right, www.johnconyers.com.
And should we be calling our members of Congress and saying support Congressman Conyers?
That's Tom, this is just like the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam movement. This is going to be a people's movement.
There you go. Okay. Congressman John Conyers, johnconyers.com, the website. Check it out. Congressman Conyers, thanks so much for being with us today.
I'd like to bring some more information to you next week.
That would be wonderful. We'll set it up.
Thank you.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much, sir, for being with us. 20 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Were you lucky enough to get an iPod for Christmas? If you did, now maybe you need some accessories. This is Dawn from Small Dog Electronics. We're the largest Apple dealer in New England, and we've got iPod accessories coming out of our... Oops. We've got a lot of...
fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
Have you forgotten?
There's an old poster out west, as I recall, that said, wanted, dead or alive.
Have you forgotten?
We'll smoke him out of his cave. And we'll get him eventually.
Have you forgotten?
Capture Bin Laden, kill him, and bring his head back in a box on dry ice.
Have you forgotten?
Basically, the president botched their response to 9/11. He should have gone right after Bin Laden.
Have you forgotten?
We should have focused on finding Bin Laden and demolishing Al-Qaeda.
Have you forgotten?
Before going down and starting a war in Iraq.
Have you?
Why did we put all our military resources into Iraq, which was our number five security threat?
Have you forgotten?
Donald Rumsfeld said, there were no good targets in Afghanistan. Let's bomb Iraq.
Have you forgotten?
And we said, but Iraq had nothing to do with this. And that didn't seem to make much difference.
Have you forgotten?
We'll never know if we could have gotten him Bin Laden because we didn't make it a priority. Yeah, well, welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, they've said it. They've said it. John Kerry and Joe Lieberman, they said it. John Kerry said, and I quote, "I am prepared to filibuster, if necessary, any Supreme Court nominee who would turn back the clock on a woman's right to choose or the constitutional right to privacy, on civil rights and individual liberties, and on the laws protecting workers and the environment." John Kerry. Joe Lieberman said, and I quote, "If I feel that President Bush nominated the Supreme Court judges that aren't independent and have basically prejudged cases, I will join or, if necessary, lead a filibuster against that nomination." They said it in June of 2003 when they were running for president against each other. John Kerry, Joe Lieberman. Kerry went on to say, in saying, "I'm prepared to filibuster, if necessary, any Supreme Court nominee who would turn back the clock on a woman's right to choose." He said the basic test, any person who thinks it's his or her job to push an extreme political agenda rather than to interpret the law, should not be a Supreme Court justice. Yep. They said it. John Kerry and Joe Lieberman, they said it. And maybe they should be reminded that they said it. A vote no on a nominee is a vote yes, unless it's backed up with a vote yes for a filibuster to stop that nomination. 27 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Just take what you need. Don't empty out this bar.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. General Motors reports big losses in further sign of industry woes. This 23 minutes ago came out of the New York Times. Yeah, and China is going to be importing into the United States a $10,000 vehicle, and the import tariff that China is going to pay when that vehicle is brought into the United States, we still have some tariffs. They've just been radically reduced by multilateral trade agreements, bilateral trade agreements, the WTO agreements, the CAFTA agreements, the NAFTA agreements. These are all things that chip away at tariffs. China is going to pay a maximum of 2%. In import tax, also known as a tariff, when they bring their new $10,000 vehicle into the United States. So they're going to have to pay a $200 tax to bring that thing into the United States. 2%. However, if Ford wants to sell Fords in China, the largest emerging market in the world right now, or the fastest growing, if Ford wants to sell Fords in China, they have to pay a 25% tariff to the Chinese government on importation. You get it? You got these free trade clowns running around Congress going, "Oh, yeah, free trade, it's wonderful." You got people like Thomas Friedman saying, "This is the future, this is how it's supposed to be." And you got countries like the communist dictatorship of China sitting back going, these suckers. I can't believe it. These suckers. They're buying our stuff. They're cutting the import tariffs so that their own companies can't compete with us. We're eating their lunch. We're buying their businesses. We're buying their cities. We're buying their everything. And we're holding enough of their debt that we can bring their government to its knees. All we have to do is just twist a little bit to the right or the left, and they will, like that. That's all we have to do, say the Chinese. And maybe we'll go after Taiwan. Maybe we'll go after Taiwan. Now, at the same time, in China, listen to today's Wall Street Journal. The Chinese people themselves are a little less up about this. While China's economy is still surging, so too are public complaints about some of the pro-market changes fueling the growth, writes Kathy Chen in today's Wall Street Journal. Economists who favor market liberalization, long respected as the high priests of economic reform, are under attack for their alleged ties to special interest groups. Gee, what a surprise. This is the point I made yesterday. Capitalism is an economic system, and a marvelous one when it's appropriately regulated. However, it's not a moral system, and it's not a system of governance. For 7,000 years, we had capitalism in the presence of dictatorships. It worked just fine. In fact, it supported those dictatorships. As Kathy Chen adds in the Wall Street Journal, more and more job applicants are seeking the security of a government job rather than take a chance on a private company. Even some relatively well-off urbanites are grumbling in opinion polls that they aren't benefiting much from economic changes. She adds there's growing anecdotal evidence of misgivings about some of the fallout from the government's moves to free up the economy, from rampant corruption and a widening wealth gap to a rise in cases of depression and other social problems. In my book, What Would Jefferson Do? I don't have it right in front of me. I don't have the statistics at my fingertips. But there's a chapter in there that talks about how a study that was done by the British Health Service, as I recall, back about 6-8 years ago, where they found that whenever the Conservatives were in power in Great Britain, suicide rates went up. And whenever the Liberals were in power in Great Britain, the suicide rates went down. And it's not because people are sitting around going, oh my God, it's the Conservatives in power, I think I'll kill myself. No, it's not that. It's that when the Conservatives came into power, life became more difficult for average people. And it became much more friendly for very wealthy people. One example of evident public anxiety can be found in the job market, writes Kathy Chen in today's Wall Street Journal. She said, "But in an indication that many people now want the security of a state job, nearly 1 million people, a record high, vied for 10,282 central government posts last year. 10,000 jobs, they've got 1 million people applying for them. Interesting little graph, in fact, in this. And then there's a little sidebar here piece by Andrew Brown. China's economy expanded by 9.9% in 2005. And Bush is going to tell you on Tuesday in the State of the Union address, he's going to tell you, isn't it wonderful how our economy is growing? 2% and change. This is growth in the fourth quarter of last year was also 9.9%, National Bureau of Statistics said. This is in China. In fact, they say slower U.S. demand is likely the biggest risk to Chinese growth this year, which otherwise looks promising. Why would we have slower U.S. growth? Because 25 years of conservative economic policies are in the process of destroying the American middle class. And as the housing bubble begins to evaporate, it's going to make it even harder for people to buy things made in China. The fundamental and tragic, frankly, reality is that if you look at the 5 years since George W. Bush came in and took apart at least the domestic programs that Bill Clinton had wisely put into place, the domestic economic program. I think Bill Clinton's international trade policies were crazy. He drank the Kool-Aid. I'll give him that it was an experiment. And he thought it would be a bold stroke and a fine thing, and he really believed these guys. You know, Milton Friedman, the Chicago School, all those, he believed them. And he was wrong. And hopefully someday he'll admit it. But at least domestically, he was following rational policies and, you know, got taxes up to the point where we were actually paying down the federal debt. We were running the government for what it costs. And he reduced the size of government. Bill Clinton, in the 8 years that he was in office, reduced by a total of 300,000 the number of employees the federal government has. One measurement of the size of government. But what we see is that in the 5 years since George W. Bush came in and started this totally insane policy of tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires and funding the thing by borrowing money from China. Yeah, we'll borrow money from you. We'll sell you some stuff. We'll borrow some money from you. And borrowing money from China, that the economy has gotten progressively worse for the average American, and as a result, the only way that the average American has been able to keep up with things has been by taking equity out of their homes. You can really tell how the economy is doing by watching the commercials on TV, seeing what the commercials are. And when you see that the DITEC and mortgages are us and we'll help you get a mortgage, when you see that those ads are everywhere, something's going on. What was going on is that in order to just stay level, to keep going, people have been noticing, hey, the value of their house went up 5, 10, 15, 20%, depending on where they lived, which meant that the equity in their home, the theoretical equity in their home, increased, and so they increased their mortgage. They took, they call it taking some equity out of your home. Really what it means is going deeper in debt. And that has been what has been fueling this so-called economic recovery ever since 2001, when Bush's initial tax policy so whacked our nation's economy that we slid into a recession. The only thing that has been propping it up is Alan Greenspan driving down interest rates to the point where mortgage payments started dropping to the point where people were looking around going, hey, I should refinance my house at 4 or 5%, and now my payments are lower, and I can take some of this money out of the house. And in a really scary move, we're seeing that as many as a third in some studies in some parts of the country, over half of the new mortgages being taken out of these adjustable rate mortgages, in some cases no interest or all interest, no principal mortgages. People aren't just borrowing against the value of their house. They're borrowing against the value of their house in a way that would make the stock market speculation on margin back in 1929 look cautious. And they're taking that money and living on it. They're buying stuff made in China. And the Chinese are getting a little worried. Not just a little worried. Because they still have these rules in place. Like, you know, if we export a car to the United States, we pay a maximum 2% tariff. But if Ford, laying off 30,000 workers, General Motors, laying off 25,000 workers, if one of these companies wants to export a car to China, 25% tariff. 25% tariff. And there are still people defending this in the United States Congress. In fact, they want to expand it. They say, oh, we got to expand this to the entire, all of Central America with CAFTA. This is absolute madness. Now, at the same time, we find in today's Wall Street Journal, India's move to open its retail sector a bit more has raised a tricky question for politicians and business executives. How many jobs will be created from this small opening versus how many neighborhood stores will be lost? They don't know. But they're starting to get really nervous. They have now, keep in mind, 95% of all retail business in India is done by mom and pop shops because it's illegal. What Walmart does in the United States is illegal for Walmart or even an Indian version of Walmart to do in India. They protect their local retailers. And they're just starting to crack that open, and it's really spooky, the people in India. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
smoking. Well, here's what I want you to do. Go to a drugstore and take a Stop Smoking product off the shelf. Go to the cashier. Tell him you don't want to pay for the product. You just want to take it home and try it. And if, and only if, you stop smoking, will you then come back and pay for it. Most likely, if you tried this, you'd be arrested. But as silly as this sounds, this is exactly what the Smoke-Free free trial offer is. Smoke-Free is a complete all-natural stop smoking system. And when you call today, they will send you a 30-day supply of the program absolutely free. This program eliminates withdrawals, cravings, and includes a 30-day supply of the Smoke-Free capsules, a Guide to Living Smoke-Free book, an audio support program, a capsule holder, and a bottle of weight loss capsules, just in case you are worried about gaining weight while you're trying to quit. To find out if you qualify for this free trial offer, join the tens of thousands who have quit for life with Smoke-Free. Call 1-800-684-5908. That's 1-800-684-5908. This is a limited-time offer, so call 1-800-684-5908 now.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. In our next hour, we're going to hear all about Jenna Bush. Stranger than you thought. And in the third hour of our program, we're going to have Susan Lerner, the executive director of the California Clean Money Campaign. Interesting things going on in California. Very interesting stuff going on in California. I'll tell you about that in the third hour of our program. Right now, I'm going to go to your calls in just a second. First, I have to share this with you. The Wall Street Journal, this incredible juxtaposition today. On the front page, this article, Bush plays down bailout prospects for GM and Ford. And President Bush said General Motors Corp and Ford Motor Company should develop, quote, a product that's relevant, end quote, rather than look to Washington for help with their heavy pension obligations, and hinted he would take a dim view of government bailout of the struggling auto manufacturers. This is by Chris Cooper and John McKinnon. So Bush says to the auto industry, yeah, it's just 50,000 jobs. You guys can go take a leap. So that story starts on page one, and it jumps to page four. So I turn to page four. And, you know, the story continues. Bush says, I think it's very important for the market to function. But the story at the top of page four is titled, Bush Tries to Jumpstart Nuclear Power. I am wondering if the editors of the Wall Street Journal did this intentionally for the ironic effect. The Bush administration, here's the article by John Falca. The Bush administration plans to announce a $250 million initiative. Now, this is federal money supporting an industry. Which happens, by the way, well, we'll get to that in just a second, which happens, by the way, to own a good chunk of the media, let's say. The Bush administration plans to announce a $250 million initiative to reprocess spent nuclear fuel, a first step toward reversing a 1970s policy that rejected reprocessing as too dangerous to pursue. The administration's decision to put the money into its fiscal 2007 budget to test new technologies is part of an effort to jumpstart the nuclear power industry. No, yeah, okay, so the auto industry, 50,000 jobs, you guys get lost. Nuclear power industry, we'll give you $250 million tomorrow if we can. As the article in the Wall Street Journal says, the Bush proposal, tentatively called the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, would give U.S. vendors such as General Electric Corp., which I might add owns NBC, MSNBC, and CNBC, would give U.S. vendors such as General Electric Corp. opportunities to sell nuclear power reactors and nuclear fuel to developing nations. So we're gonna take our tax dollar. We're not gonna do anything with Ford and GM. We say, you know, you guys screwed up. You designed cars that weren't the cars people make, and they're not buying them. And tough luck. And there's certain truth to that. Except that it's not a level playing field that they're operating on. When China can import a car with a 2% tariff, and yet if you try to export a car to China, you have to pay a 25% tariff to China. I'm sorry, it's not a level playing field. Bush doesn't care about that. He wants to try and help General Electric sell nuclear power plants to other countries with our money. With our money. Philip in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, Philip, welcome to the program.
Hello. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Tom. I just finished reading the book that you worked on, The Ultimate Sacrifice.
Yeah.
And
about Kennedy. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yes, it was incredible. I was late for work a couple times. it was real. Amazing piece of work and a page turner. I highly recommend it. I'm not going to talk too much about it in terms of giving it away, but yeah. I just have to thank you and your co-author for writing that book.
Yeah, LeVar Waldron. Thank you, Philip. But that's not what you called about.
No, sir, it isn't. It's so much like living under with the mafia as your government. The more I look at the comparisons, you have loan sharking going on. You have a protection industry going on, which is the Defense Department. We want our citizens to live in fear and that we have a godfather to protect us. And the other thing that I find real similar to the mafia in the way this administration operates is they're all lawyered up very, very well.
Yeah.
They reward loyalty. They want you to be silent, to not talk about what they do. It's really incredible when you run down the list of how they operate.
Philip, I don't disagree with you at all. In fact, what it reminds me of more than the mafia, frankly, is the old Soviet Union, which also was run like organized crime in some ways. By the way, we just confirmed this. Margaret in Bremerton, Washington has the announcement. I'll let you do it, Margaret.
Hi, Tom. I called Senator Kerry's office to remind him of his 2003 speech. And the person cut me off and said that Kerry fully supports the filibuster and he's trying to get his colleagues to go along. And I repeated that to him, and he said yes.
Yeah, and we just called his office to confirm that, and they said yes, John Kerry stands behind a filibuster.
So hopefully.
Step by step, we'll see what happens, Margaret.
Yeah, we need to keep calling.
There you go. Thank you. David in Bainbridge Island. Hey, David.
Hi. There was some discussion of diabolical voting machines. I wonder, is the Democratic Party doing anything to legally challenge the irregularities in these votes, or are you going to have a paper trail to confirm the actual amount of votes that were cast in the next election?
Well, the problem is that the law doesn't say explicitly that you can't privatize the vote. And, yeah, I mean, you know, common sense would say that, but there's apparently no law. And so when the Democratic Party in Alaska, for example, which is what we were talking about yesterday, goes to the state of Alaska and says, please give us the vote count. The state of Alaska then goes to Diebold and says, please give us the vote count. And Diebold says, no, we won't give you the actual original files. We're not talking about the software. We're just talking about the databases. We won't give you the files, the actual files that came out of the memory of the computers, because we might be revealing a proprietary secret. We own it, basically, they're saying. I mean, you know, they're using the trade secret excuse. And the problem here, Philip, is a more fundamental one than just voting. It's a problem that we have given to corporations the rights of persons, and it's wrong. We need to take it away from them, abolish corporate personhood. That's a whole other rant, but it's something we need to do. And we need to get them out of the business of handling our vote. It is absolutely insane that private, for-profit corporations are handling our votes in secret and then telling us how we voted. Makes no sense. Makes no sense at all. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, Al Gore showed up. He showed up at Sundance. That's absolutely great. Why did he show up at Sundance? We'll get to that in just a second. Welcome back to our program. 6 minutes after the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for change. As in change of government, you know. It's Jeffrey Kleinman is the editor of DVD Talk, an online magazine, and he's live at DVDTalk.com, by the way, as you might have inferred, the website. He's live at the Sundance Film Festival. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, how's it going?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up with you?
Well, man, I've been seeing many, many great movies. It's just been a fantastic fest with some just truly exceptional films.
Well, let's start out with the Al Gore movie.
Yeah, The Inconvenient Truth.
Right.
Wow. Really impressive. Al Gore came out to introduce and answer questions after this documentary, which follows, you know, his presentation that he did around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's combined with a real intimate portrait of Gore. And, man, if you were impressed by Gore before, after you see this film, you're going to be bowled over.
Well, I got to tell you, he came here to Portland to speak, and I went to the presentation. It was his global warming, you know, basically a PowerPoint presentation. I mean, Al Gore does a PowerPoint presentation, right? And the room would hold 3,000 people, as I recall, and it was full. It was absolutely full. We got there an hour early, and we got in, you know, toward the front. And they closed the doors, and another couple thousand people showed up. And they started banging on the doors in the back and chanting. And so Al Gore came out, and he said, you know, I'll do a second gig. No problem. And so they told all the people, you know, outside, hey, calm down. He'll do a second gig for you. And they hung around. And he did this presentation that just knocked my socks off. I thought it was one of the very best presentations I'd ever seen. Forget the fact that it was Al Gore, a politician, or anybody. I mean, just on global warming and on politics and on the intersection. It was brilliant. And if this movie, An Inconvenient Truth, captures the Al Gore that I saw, I mean, that's why ever since then I've been saying this is the guy who, you know, the only president of the United States who was never president of the United States and damn well should be.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the big thing about it is that it not only captures it, but it adds to it because you get the background of why Al Gore is so passionate about global warming and his whole history behind it. When this hits theaters, this is going to be a huge documentary. And the great thing is it's going to go to cities that Al could never have gone with his slideshow presentation. So I'm very excited about the movie.
That's marvelous. Now, a few other movies that are showing at Sundance. So Much So Fast, what's this?
Yeah, this is just a jaw-droppingly good documentary about a 30-something-year-old guy, you know, about my age, who gets Lou Gehrig's disease. And it's really a poignant portrait of this family who don't take no for an answer from drug companies who say that Lou Gehrig's disease is an orphan disease and they're not going to do anything about it. They start a foundation and they get busy and they get people together to try to help to find ways to treat and cure Lou Gehrig's disease. So this is an Oscar-worthy documentary, and you'll be hearing a lot about So Much So Fast.
Without giving away the movie to the point that somebody wouldn't want to go see it, although I think even when people know how movies end, they want to go see them because they want to, you know, they want the effects, they want the sense of it, they want the reality of it. Did they come up with anything for ALS?
Well, you know, it's like a lot of things. They came up with some answers, but not the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a devastatingly emotional documentary with high highs and low lows. And it's hard to remember a film that really touched me as much as this one did.
Mm, okay. The Ground Truth, After the Killing Ends. This is another documentary.
Yeah. If you've ever, you know, really wanted to see what life is like for a soldier from recruitment all the way through war and back again, The Ground Truth gives a real behind-the-scenes look at how soldiers are recruited, exactly how they're trained to becoming kill machines. There's footage from Iraq from non-embedded journalists and from soldiers themselves. And most importantly, the not-so-great world that they come back to after serving their time, things like healthcare, being a doctor, integrating back into their lives.
Mm.
And The Ground Truth is just a profound look at that, and I think it's going to get people really talking about the reality of what we're doing over in Iraq.
Is this The Ground Truth, After the Killing Ends? Is this documentary, is this movie going to be widely distributed, or is this going to be one of those things that's just going to be in DVD? Not to say that you know, is minor, but I mean, is it going to have a major theater release?
It hasn't, to my knowledge, it hasn't gotten picked up yet. But I wouldn't be surprised if it does. It's got to look at this whole thing that no other film has. So I would expect pretty much all the films that I'm talking about today, if not to be in theaters the first part of this year, by the end of the year, I'm sure you'll be seeing them in theaters.
Yeah, we're talking with Jeffrey Kleinman, the editor of DVDtalk.com, online magazine, and he's live at the Sundance Film Festival. This film is not yet rated. I understand that there's a movie playing that basically rips apart the whole, you know, pulls back the curtain and lets you see how movies get rated and what are all the internal politics and all the weirdness that's going on.
Yeah, it's almost like I wish I didn't know, because now I can't unknow. The MPAA, which, you know, basically regulates and rates the movies that we get to see, and often changes, make, you know, suggested changes so that filmmakers can fulfill their contracts to send out movies with certain ratings, is actually run by a secret board that we don't know their names of. And through some investigation, Kirby Dick uncovered who they are and some information about the way the whole process works. And it's really, really, really staggering. The big thing is, you know, this is a censorship board, and not only is it a censorship board, but it's a censorship board that's got clergy on it. So there are clergy members who are involved in the deciding of if something's going to get an NC-17 or an R in the appeals process, which is just, talk about separation of church and state. When it comes to movies, there's some issues there.
Well, this is really kind of separation of church and industry, although... The ratings, is the rating system congressionally imposed, or is it industry imposed?
It's industry imposed, and I think, you know, a lot of people who were interviewed in the film basically said we would rather have the government come in because then there would be some sort of standards.
There would be some transparency to it.
Yeah, and as it is now, it's you know, it's a little secret society that meets in secret and has really ambiguous rules and situational ethics. You know, in one sense, they say this is okay, and then in this one, it's not. And a real problem, and I think filmmaker Kirby Dick has put the discussion on the table. And so hopefully this will open the discussion and potentially open the door to a better system out there.
And in the film, this film is not yet rated. We're speaking with Jeffrey Kleinman, editor of DVDtalk.com. In the film, this film is not yet rated, which sounds like a confusing sentence, but you get it. I'm wondering if, in addition to talking about how the clergy are involved, which presumably is all about sex, right, in all probability, is there a political component to this secret board?
Well, yeah, they're all Republicans. All.
You're kidding.
Of them.
They're all Republicans?
All of them. All the people that they had investigated on the ratings board were all conservatives. So, and one of the results of that is, they did side-by-side showings of two sex scenes, one between two guys, one between a girl and a guy, same exact scene. One is NC-17, the others are. So it has a pretty profound effect, and there's some definite political you know, bias behind what we can see at theaters and what is considered safe for families.
Yeah, I mean, I would think, speaking as the parent of three now grown children, but nonetheless, you know, as a parent, And just as a, you know, as a person living in this society, in my own personal taste, I find violence more offensive, frankly, and I think it's more destructive to kids than sex on the screen.
Yeah,
I mean, sex is something we're all going to do. Killing people is not something we're all going to do. In fact, it's something we're all not supposed to do. Why is it that these guys would say it's fine to have movies where they're killing people, or it's fine where everybody's smoking cigarettes because the tobacco industry has spiffed the filmmaker, and tobacco kills 500,000 Americans every year, but it's not okay to have people having sex on screen?
Yeah, it's shocking. It's really shocking, and you know, it really goes to, you know, what kind of society it kind of gets developed when, you know, the steady diet of movies is killing. And one of the points they made is, you know, it's even worse for children to see a film where somebody gets shot and there's no blood.
Right.
Because that shows that there's just no consequence. It's, you know, so it's
right.
A fantasy violence.
It inures them to violence.
Yeah. Yeah. So this film really brings up some real, I think, germane topics to, you know, entertainment and relationship to, you know, our culture. And it's part of the culture wars. It really is. And there's a conservative stronghold that's really working to control what we see in the movie theaters and what gets the R rating, which can go everywhere and be advertised, or NC-17, which can't be advertised on television and won't be carried in, you know, a good percentage of the movie theaters across the country.
Jeffrey Kleinman, editor of DVDtalk.com. We have just a few seconds left. Just to, off the top of your head, a few other quick titles that we should be keeping our eye out for.
Yeah, some great ones. Who Killed the Electric Car? An Unreasonable Man about Ralph Nader. Iraq and Fragments, another great political doc on Iraq. Steel City, and one of my favorites, which is a Harry Cruz-based film called The Hawk is Dying with Paul Giamatti, which is just stunning. Probably will win the Best Director Award.
Great.
We'll
Jeffrey Kleinman, DVDtalk.com. Thank you, Jeffrey. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
George Bush went down to the Trade Center right after 9/11. The words he spoke, they made me feel like, wow, we're not just going to sit back on our asses and do nothing.
Osama bin Laden released an audio tape today claiming more attacks on U.S. soil were imminent.
The newest audio tape from Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden was reportedly recorded this month.
This is the 19th message released either by video or audio tape by bin Laden since 9/11.
It's almost inconceivable that bin Laden is still a free man.
Osama bin Laden has eluded capture by U.S. forces since the attacks of September 11, 2001, that killed nearly 3,000 Americans.
Yeah, I thought they were the ones that kept saying, remember 9/11, have you forgotten, have you forgotten?
Sing that song.
I'd love to play that song for President Bush right now.
Have you forgotten?
Andy.
How it felt that day.
I saw an airplane.
See your homeland under fire. And her people going away. Have
and welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Yeah, no, I haven't forgotten, and the massive failure of intelligence and response and security by the Bush administration on November 11th of 2001. This happened on their watch. They were warned over 50 specific times, according to the 9/11 Commission. They did nothing to stop or prevent it. And no, I haven't forgotten. Welcome back. Greg Gorman with Talk Radio News is with us, talkradionews.com. Hey, Greg.
Hello, Tom. Well, the president finds himself between a rock and a hard place today. You probably watched the press conference this morning in the White House press briefing room.
I didn't. I was on the air. So,
oh, right.
So
yeah,
I missed
God,
it.
Of course you were.
So give me a quick tip here.
Well, you know, the first quick tip is this unexpected, you know, victory by Hamas in the Palestinian elections.
Right.
We have the president saying on one hand he's happy that there are elections and we are fighting, obviously, in Iraq for, you know, in order to have democracies. And yet, on the other hand, now the people who've won the election are people who have called for the, you know, for the full extermination of Israel, and the president says that he will not support them.
Right.
So, you know, on one hand, he's calling for democracy, and he's happy that people voted, but he's not happy with the way it turned out.
Yeah,
we're going to see how he handles this.
Yeah, there's that inconsistency. There's also the fact that we are now friends with Gaddafi, and, you know, before we became friends with him, when we started buying oil from him again, he was a terrorist. Now he's not a terrorist. It's like one of the things that I find really interesting about this whole thing. Yeah, I mean, you scroll back 50 years, 70 years, I think, more or less, it was in the 1940s, as I recall. Menachem Begin, as I recall, he was the second prime minister of Israel. He, before Israel was brought into existence, he blew up the King David Hotel. You know, it was a terrorist strike, and he became a non-terrorist and became the president of the country. And I think it's a marvelous thing, you know, that he was able to turn like that, and he and his organization. And, you know, Hamas, a lot of what they do and a lot of the reason why they're so popular isn't their political stance pro or anti-Israel. It's that they run hospitals and schools in areas that have nothing. That have none. And I wonder if it's possible that by engaging them, we can help them make that same transition that Begin made and that, you know, we are suggesting Gaddafi has made and that we are hoping that Musharraf and what's his name in Egypt, Mubarak, has made or are making, you know, from some sort of a totalitarian standard, or at least a standard that is inconsistent with being a member of the world community to being a good and healthy member of the world community.
Well, and that's exactly what the president said. And to his credit, he did say he'll watch very carefully how they form their government. And, of course, if they continue to be a terrorist organization, we've heard from the White House on several occasions, including earlier this week from Scott McClellan, we do not deal with terrorists. So,
right.
You know, it really puts the president up against the wall. If Hamas is planning to continue on its path of calling for the extermination of Israel, if we continue to see them as a terrorist organization that they are, then the president cannot deal with them. And
right.
Now we're
dealing with the PLO, and the PLO used to have part of its charter the extermination
of
Israel,
and then they changed. What I was going to get to in the beginning is that he's really between a rock and a hard place, because he's talking about we will not deal with terrorists, but of course we deal with terrorists, and we deal with terrorist groups all the time. We have not dealt with Al-Qaeda, and that is, of course, now the most famous terrorist organization.
We actually have a law on the books right now that says that we can't deal with Hamas if they, you know, Jimmy Carter was talking about this yesterday. He said if Hamas takes the executive branch, that is the prime minister or presidency of you know, what is this called? Is it called Palestine now?
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, of Palestine. Then we can't deal with them. But if they simply take control of the legislative branch and a non-Hamas person becomes the executive, then we can deal with that country. And I thought that was an interesting distinction.
Well, and of course, the ruling Fatah Party prime minister has resigned. Of course, Mahmoud Abbas, who's the president, has not, of course, and he's going to try to work with the new legislature. But if there becomes a Hamas-ruled executive in addition to the legislature, then you know what you say is exactly right, and we're going to run into serious problems.
Yeah. We'll see how it all shakes out. Greg Gorman, we have about 20 seconds left. The Senate Judiciary Committee, Arlen Specter, says he might subpoena Jimmy Carter and George Herbert Walker Bush to testify about domestic wiretapping. Is George W. got his back to the wall here?
Well, he does, and if you listen to people around Washington, this was only not a run-up to the State of the Union, this press conference. It was also he's still trying to sell the idea every single thing he did was legal. You know, he said it was legal. He said it was continued to be legal, and he did it all to protect the American people.
Yeah,
and,
the best defense is a good offense. Yeah, yeah, and he's absolutely going on the offense. You know, we have Karl Rove out here saying the Democrats don't want to protect America, right? It's like, this
is nuts. Start on February 6th. We heard from Senator Specter. All this will come out.
Yeah. Greg Gorman of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Great having you here with us, Greg. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And they look at you like they don't speak your language.
Yeah, they're conservatives.
And you're living at the bottom of a well.
That's where the conservatives want you. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Truth and common sense in broadcasting here on the True People's Radio. Every now and then, it's appropriate, I think, to visit with some dead presidents. I don't know how to put it beyond that. Catch a little bit of history. And I want to put this in the context of what's going on today, even though this has to do with civil rights. The foundational principle that Sam Alito, John Roberts, Antonin Scalia, and Thomas, Clarence Thomas, stand for, and many conservative, most Republicans and some conservative Democrats, what they stand for is this concept that the marketplace can do it better than government can do it. You know, it's Ronald Reagan's old, you know, chuckle, chuckle, tee hee, roar, roar, you know, is that, you know, our Democratic friends have it all wrong. They don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what they're doing.
Yet any time you and I question the schemes of the do-gooders, we're denounced as being against their humanitarian goal. They say we're always against things. We're never for anything. Well, the trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
Yeah, and of course, that, you know, great,
I have talked
great,
to-
great laugh line right there. And so anyhow, that's, you know, from Reagan forward, there has been this essentially war on government by we the people. And what they would replace it with is corporatocracy, is corporations. And, you know, they really believe that. So here is, in 1960, Richard Nixon and John Kennedy debating before the presidency. And African Americans were not allowed to sit in Woolworths all across the United States. We're not allowed to sit in lunch counters with white people. And so they said to the two of them, what should we do about this? And Nixon says, we should call in the corporations and ask them to behave nicely. All right, here's Nixon's take on it.
I have talked to Negro mothers. I've heard them try to explain how they tell their children how they can go into a store and buy a loaf of bread, but then can't go into that store and sit at the counter and get a Coca-Cola. This is wrong, and we have to do something about it. So under the circumstances, what do we do? Well, what we do is what the Attorney General of the United States did under the direction of the President. Call in the owners of chain stores and get them to take action.
There you go. Now, that's Richard Nixon saying that what we need to do is call in the owners of the chain stores and get them to take action. Keep in mind, he was the vice president of the United States at this time, had been for 8 years, and they had already called in the attorney general, and they had already called in the president of the chain stores, and the president of the chain stores says, tough, we're not going to do this. So John Kennedy, and see, this is where we are with health care. This is where we are with civil rights. This is where we are with a woman's right to abortion. This is the way, you can go right on down the list over and over again. The conservatives are going to say the government has no right protecting these rights or involving itself in these fields, whereas, turn it over to private corporations or leave it to the open marketplace or whatever, and that'll be the solution. Here's John Kennedy's rebuttal to Richard Nixon's comments that we can't do anything about segregation in 1960. What we should do about segregation in 1960 is to bring in the chairman of the big corporations and ask them to behave nicely. Kennedy says no. He's got a better way.
Senator Kennedy.
Well, Mr. Nixon hasn't discussed the two basic questions. What is going to be done and what will be his policy on implementing the Supreme Court decision of 1954? Giving aid to schools technically that are trying to carry out the decision is not the great question. Secondly, what's he going to do to provide fair employment? He's been the head of the Committee on Government Contracts. It's carried out two cases, both in the District of Columbia. He has not indicated his support of an attempt to provide fair employment practices around the country so that everyone can get a job regardless of their race or color.
Now, keep in mind, Nixon was vice president at the time, and Kennedy is saying, hey, you were responsible for doing this. You didn't do it. Why? Well, because Nixon doesn't believe that government power should be used that way. Neither do Thomas Scalia, Alito, or John Roberts.
Nor has he indicated that he will support Title III, which would give the Attorney General additional powers to protect constitutional rights. These are the great questions. Equality of education in school. About 2% of our population of white people is illiterate. 10% of our colored population. 60 to 70% of our colored children do not finish high school. These are the questions. In these areas that the North and the South, East and West are entitled to know, what will be the leadership of the president in these areas to provide equality of opportunity for employment, equality of opportunity in the field of housing, which could be done on all federal-supported housing by a stroke of the president's pen? What will be done to provide equality of education in all sections of the United States? Those are the questions to which the president must establish a moral tone and moral leadership. And I can assure you that if I'm elected president, we will do so.
And he did. And when he was assassinated, his brother carried on the work and in pressuring Lyndon Johnson and as attorney general and then as a politician and on it went. So it's just people think that the modern conservatives are like some sort of, weird thing that just appeared out of nowhere. I'm here to tell you, we've had the modern conservatives. It goes all the way back to John Adams and Sir Edmund Burke and Alexander Hamilton in some regards. In many regards, it goes all the way back to the beginning that there are these folks who think, the corporations aren't behaving nicely. They won't let African-Americans sit at a lunch counter. Then let's call them in and talk to them. And, we've been doing that for 8 years and they haven't quite come around yet, but eventually they will. And then there are some of us who say it's wrong. It's a violation of the Constitution. We're not going to allow it. We're not going to allow businesses to do that, period. And we're going to enforce enforce the anti-segregation laws. We're going to enforce Brown versus Board of Education. That was decided in 1954 when Nixon was vice president. And still, the year that he became vice president. And still, throughout Nixon's vice presidency, Eisenhower's presidency, it really didn't get fully enforced until Kennedy came along. And so, this is just this fundamental schism that we see. And we're still seeing it today. George Bush, the most recent battleground where you're going to see it played out, and you're going to see it played out big, you're going to see it on the State of the Union address on Tuesday night, is George W. Bush is going to be basically saying, there's no reason for the government to get involved in protecting your health care. You should be able to make those decisions for yourself. Don't you want to have free choice? Aren't we an independent people? So you should have a health savings account. Rather than having your employer have to pay for your health care, because, the employers, it's really a burden for them. 36 other industrialized countries in the world have free national health care. Employers don't have to pay for it. So you have Toyota came over here and they wanted to build an auto factory in North America to sell cars in the United States. And they decided to build it in Canada, even though Alabama had offered them hundreds of millions of dollars in tax cuts and things. Why? Because there's more health care than stealing a car. So the answer to this from George W. Bush, let the average person take care of themselves. Let them set aside some money in a health savings account. And that way they'll shop around. Yeah, I can just see this. Can you imagine somebody having a heart attack, calling 911 and saying, I'm feeling a horrible pain in my chest. Would you please send an ambulance? And by the way, when you send the ambulance, be sure that he brings along a price list for the various hospitals so I can compare their emergency room rates so I can decide which, as he's taking me away from my house, so I can decide which hospital I want to check myself into. Come on. Healthcare is not a commodity. It's absolutely not a commodity. Any more than segregation was appropriate through or even legal, frankly, all the time, all the years that it existed in the United States, and to the extent that it still does. And yet Bush is going to try that. He's going to try and peddle this to you, I'm telling you. And it's the exact same thing coming up in a new disguise. And the same thing with regard to abortion. Nixon's position would have been, with regard to this, I can't put words in Nixon's mouth, but the corollary position would be, government shouldn't be involved in this. The government shouldn't be protecting the rights of women. That would be the conservative position. And the American position is, no, we protect minority rights, period. Mike in San Diego, California. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I just wanted to call in and say I'm kind of new to listening to KLSD. And the more I listen to it, the more I get worried because, us people just coming into it, what can we do to get more involved? I've always believed in voting for the right person for the right job. I never went down party lines. And the more I listen to both sides of the story, I realize that one side is not listening to the other. It's not that they just don't agree. They won't even listen
right to
anything that goes on. A lot of things come to light. I'm in my mid-40s, and a friend of mine has an article that was written by an interviewer who interviewed Hermann Göring in the Nuremberg trial.
I'm familiar with the quote. All you have to do is scare people, and they'll go along with anything, basically.
Well, they asked him in the interview, how did you get people to go along?
Right. Right.
And he said, well, you get some people to lead, and anyone that doesn't follow, you wave the flag in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
This is exactly what happened after 9/11.
Yeah, and this is what Bush is doing. Here we got Karl Rove coming out. He says, and I quote, President Bush believes if Al-Qaeda is calling somebody in America, it's in our national security interest to know who they're calling and why. Some important Democrats clearly disagree. I mean, this is the most blatant lie that has come out of this administration, at least in the last week. And it's this kind of thing that is, frankly, is a threat to democracy, is a threat to American democracy. Mike, the way we get involved is by showing up. I encourage you with the Democratic Party, first of all. We have to take back the Democratic Party. Show up for your local Democratic Party monthly meetings. Participate with the Green Party. Just get involved in the local political process as a start. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
In 1961, when Ike went out, the people in the South began to shout. In the last 8 years, everybody starved to death. The people up in Lucknow ain't even got breath. Please, Mr. Kennedy, won't you help us out? Willa ain't had a square meal in a long, long time. The farmers in Missouri, they ain't made a dime. The miner in West Virginia, he's really in a jam. And the hogs in Virginia, too poor to grow hams. Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Hey, welcome back, my friends. Yeah, a little bit of a campaign song there from 1960. Welcome back. 51 minutes past the hour, coming to 9 minutes before the hour. And time for our Twilight Zone alert. Yes. There were cigarette girls passing out smokes, writes Jeffrey Dufour. Chocolates and even condoms. There are bottles of vodka on the tables, courtesy of sponsor Grey Goose. There are fishnet-clad dancers sporting handcuffs and police hats gyrating on a pole. And there, somewhat incongruously, were the Bush twins. Hanging among a preppier enclave in the far corner of the club, the scene was a broken resolutions party, a celebration of vice at a new play lounge on Connecticut Avenue on Saturday night. Belying the reliable source's recent characterizations of Barbara as trampy, she was attired in a sexy yet perfectly tasteful sequin-trimmed tank top. As she sat sipping her cocktail, Jenna, ever the wild one, was spotted standing, some say dancing, on the sofa. Play owner Sharif Abdullah said he doesn't comment on any guests at the club, although with a name like that, he may have a... Secret Service, he's probably got Alberto Gonzalez on his back, was my... Anyhow, even the twin Secret Service agents wanted to fit in the pair's security details, writes Jeff Defour. Perched around their group's tables, abandoned its usual business suits and ties and opted for clubbier attire. With their resolutions now broken, we wonder what the twins will be giving up for Lent. Well, Jenna Bush may have broken her resolution not to get plastered in public, but I'm keeping mine. My New Year's resolution, same as it's been as far back as I can remember. My three criteria for a decent life. To have a decent income, to change the world in a positive way, and number one most important, to have a heck of a lot of fun doing it. And I sure am, and I'm glad you're here along with me participating in it. Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Well, you're doing a great job of it, Tom. I keep wishing that I saw things a little differently than I do, but I see the cons driver as pure, unbridled greed. You know, we've had a history of some wonderful leaders that have cared about the people and been motivated to act in our interests. I see a total absence of that now. They see us there merely to be exploited.
I don't disagree with you, Dave.
Yeah, well, see, it puts them in a... Because I take it to the point that it's not beneath them to kill a lot of people to get profits. That's why we're in Iraq. I see that.
I don't disagree with you there either, although I think that, frankly, power is what... When George Bush said back in 1999 that if he became president, the first thing he'd do was invade Iraq because it would give him political capital, and that his father had squandered the political capital that he got from invading Iraq, and George wouldn't do that. He'd have a longer war and, you know, quack, quack, quack. I think that for him, that power is not a means to wealth. Wealth is simply one dimension of power. And so, you know, I would separate the two in my mind anyway.
Well, I saw that PNAC crowd as a group of psychopaths who got together, total deceit, a plan to steal the government of this country, to put in place whatever congressmen they needed wherever that would go along with their schemes.
Yeah.
They spelled it out then. We'll need a new Pearl Harbor in order to accomplish this. And
they got it, sure enough. This is where you and I differ. You think that they created it. I think that they helped bring it about by negligence. But I'm perfectly willing to believe that your position is right, Dave. I just think we need a solid investigation of this thing, and we won't know until we get one, and we won't get one until the Democrats take control of the House, the Senate, or both. And that's why it's so important that we get politically active.
These same psychopaths still hang on to those trick voting machines, too, Tom.
I know, and we've got to do something about that as well. Dave, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Gene in New York City. Hey, Gene, what's on your mind today?
Well, actually a lot concerning this Alito nomination and a phony grassroots effort to... tell newspapers that your senator should vote yes on Alito.
Yeah, I got the email this morning from the RNC and from the the RNC one was yesterday. The one I got this morning was from Conservative Alerts, as I recall.
Well, catch this. American Politics Journal, and here I'll admit a little bit of involvement with it. I'm sort of their webmaster and general bottle washer.
Oh, American cool. What's the website?
APJ.us, American Politics Journal. Has a new article up this morning called Astroturfing for Alito. Now, astroturf, as we all know, is phony grassroots.
Yeah.
And what happened is that they got about 50 emails that pretty much read the same in support of Judge Alito, right down to the word or sets of paragraphs. And the interesting twist that they've uncovered is that a near identical excerpt from the boilerplate text made its way into a press release dated 2 days ago from something called the Christian Legal Society. It was attributed to Christian Legal Society's executive director, Sam Casey. And they're asking the question, did Casey write the letter now being spammed to newspapers across the country, or is he trying to pass off someone else's talking points as his own? They've posted about 40...
So is he a conspirator or a plagiarist?
That's exactly the question. therein lies the rub. Well, some sleuths over at democraticunderground.com have revealed that apparently the origin for this letter, or one of the origins for this letter, is conservativealerts.com. And you can go onto their site, and you can...
Well, that's the one I told you. I got the email today from Conservative Alerts. I've subscribed to their emails for a long, long time. And they're becoming actually a very influential group, so it's something to keep your eye on, Gene. And they are, far out there on the right. I mean, just as far out as you can get. Gene, I got to run. Thanks for the call, though. Great to hear from you, and thank you for listening to us there in New York City. I do appreciate it. The Tom Hartman radio program, telling the truth that the multinational corporations, really would rather you weren't all that familiar with. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Susan Lerner has been an activist for more than 25 years before joining the California Clean Money Campaign as its executive director. She founded and chaired the Committee for Judicial Independence, a grassroots organization dedicated to educating and activating Americans to the importance of an independent, open-minded federal judiciary. Boy, do we need that now. Ms. Lerner also spearheads the Justice for All Project, a California statewide coalition of organizations working to educate members and lobby elected representatives on federal judicial nominations, and has been on the steering committee for the Civil Liberties Defense Coalition, and working with the Los Angeles City Council, and former executive director of the California Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League South. And Susan Lerner, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Tom.
California Clean Money Campaign, caclean.org, the website. There's big things happening right now in California around clean money.
There certainly is. It's really a banner week for us, and we hope a banner year for really making a difference to really substantially reduce the impact of money on our public policy here in California.
So how do we do that? Well, ideally, ultimately, nationwide. Our program is running nationwide, but how are you planning on doing that in California? What specifically are you working on?
Well, specifically what we are working on is building public support for full public financing of elections in California. That would mean all of the legislative elections, all of the candidates for statewide office, be it attorney general or governor, would have the option not to be taking private money donations, not to be taking large checks from corporations and PACs, but rather working solely for the people, because the people would be the only entity paying them in any manner.
Now, it seems to me that there's really two pieces to this, Susan Lerner, with California Clean Money Campaign, caclean.org. The first is that, we have to have a mechanism for gathering and distributing this money, and I'd like to get the details of that from you, what it's going to cost or what it's going to cost the average taxpayer and how much is going to be spent. But the second is we've been seeing, and it ties into the first, I suppose, we've been seeing an explosion, an exponential explosion in the cost of campaigns. I think the last presidential cycle was either $1 or $2 billion, and the one before that was half that, and the one before that was half that. I mean, they've been literally doubling every 4 years. And the vast majority of those expenses have been the cost of media. And this goes back to the decision that, I believe it goes back to the decision that Ronald Reagan made back in 86, 87 to stop enforcing the Fairness Doctrine and the pieces associated with it that required media to provide free airtime for politicians. How do we say to the taxpayers, We're all going to kick in some money to give to politicians to run their campaigns. And by the way, that money is ultimately going to end up in the pockets of NBC, ABC, and CBS or local affiliates thereof. And on the other hand, how do you say to the media, we're going to clean up the money thing here, but we don't have enough money to hit everybody for the kind of campaigns that have been run, and so you guys are going to have to make less advertising revenue?
Well, I think that it is really a question of finding creative solutions for this. I think it's also a question of the media has to be responsive, and our regulatory agencies and our government in Washington have to be responsive to the very real concerns of the people. I think there are people working on the federal level who have some very creative ideas for what can be done in addition to reintroducing what was called the Fairness Doctrine, which you mentioned was repealed during the Reagan years. There's the possibility of setting up special funds which would pay for advertising. And some of the states I know are taking a look at what can be done. We're taking a look at the local level here in Los Angeles, what can be done with cable franchise contracts, which cities have. Are there ways in which we can help get candidate information out that way? And also there's always the question of should there be some sort of a sales tax on advertising, which could go into a fund, which would pay for the advertising which election candidates need to do. That would be kind of a neat idea.
Yeah, fact of the matter is that I've been in this industry for over 30 years, and there was probably a 20-year gap there where I was out, but I worked in radio from 68 to 78 and then came back three years ago now and started doing this program.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the 60s and 70s when I worked in this business, very little revenue was coming into the radio stations that I was working at as campaign money. I mean, during the campaign season, they'd see a bump, but it wasn't a big deal.
Yeah.
And now we have media that has grown essentially addicted to that every other year burst of cash.
Well, part of that, Tom, is I think the extraordinary amounts of money which are being raised and spent. Part of it, I think, also is a response to the very real and very troubling disengagement on the part of a large segment of the population.
Right.
And where you have people who don't have faith in their government and who are cynical about the process of elections, then you have to work that much harder to kind of barrage them to get their attention. If people had a more direct connection to the people who were running for office, if they felt that their voices counted and their opinions counted, then I believe that there would be less of the kind of saturation advertising that you're talking about.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I'm just thinking that from the point of view of, for example, a network or a local station, that they're going to be less inclined to cover what you're doing as a news story if they think that if you're successful, it's going to mean that they're going to lose that every other year bump in advertising revenue that essentially is allowing them to be profitable in these times of declining revenue in advertising.
Well, that's an interesting point. You're talking about the situation where, to me, it requires a marketplace with a bit more regulation to it, so that you don't have the kind of price gouging, which we see very definitely here in California, where political ads are much more expensive than other forms of advertising.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how have Arizona, I was curious about how Arizona did it, but how do you have specifics about how you're proposing to do it in California? I mean, do you have a here's what we're going to do. Everybody's going to pay $5 a year into a fund or something like that. I mean, have you got it reduced down to the point where here's what it's going to cost you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
tell me about
it. We definitely do. Well, right
we,
now,
we have about 2 minutes left here.
Okay, we have a bill pending in the legislature that we helped to draft that's carried by Assemblywoman Lonnie Hancock that's going to be voted on, we believe, in the Assembly, we believe, on Monday. We know it's going to be voted on. We know it's going to be debated. And basically, we've set up a system where candidates who want to work solely for the public will be able to get public funds. It is a very modest cost when you compare it to the California budget. We estimate it would cost approximately $5.50 to be placed into a fund based on the number of adults in California. And that's the cost of a latte and a muffin.
That's per person per year
per
for
year.
Adults. right.
per
okay.
year.
Yeah.
And what we're looking at are what we call dedicated funding sources, not allocations from the general fund. This should not be and will not be in competition with education, roads, et cetera. But we'll have a dedicated funding source. We're looking at things like an oil extraction fee. California is the only oil-producing region in the world, and certainly the only oil-producing region in the country that doesn't charge a royalty to oil companies when they take that non-renewable resource, oil, out of
our Wait a minute. When an oil company takes oil out from under the under public land in California, they don't pay the state of California for that oil?
No.
But you're kidding.
Texas does it. Alaska does it.
I know.
Wyoming.
That's how Alaska floats their government. That's one of the reasons you got Ted Stevens running around going, drill it, Anwar!
Yeah, they make so much money off it.
Yeah.
Most of Wyoming's state government is paid for by oil extraction fees, but California missed the boat there. There are other sources. A conservative columnist in our Sacramento Bee newspaper suggested that it would make sense to modestly increase the corporate and the banking tax. That's paid here in California, less than 0.5%, and that would pay for all of the clean money funding that would be needed.
Yeah,
there are a lot of different ways.
So
in which
what
you
so
it.
Then what your bill is doing is simply mandating it, but not specifying the mechanism. Do I have that right, Susan Lerner?
I'm sorry. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Because you're saying it's going to cost so little, and I know you're right. I've done the math. And yet you're saying that there's a variety of ways to do it. I think that's great.
Well, we want to be creative, and we want to be sure that, as I said, it's not in competition with education and health care and other important state functions. But the idea also, remember, Tom, if this system is in place, it's going to pay for itself in terms of over the long run. Government giveaways that our elected officials are going to be able to turn back. Loopholes, tax loopholes, they're going to be able to close. The real question is not how can we afford it. The real question is how can we afford not to have it.
Well said. Susan Lerner, the executive director of the California Clean Money Campaign, their website, caclean.org. Check it out if you want more information, if you want to pitch in and help out. Susan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program. The lawsuit demanded that Bush and Blair appear before court to answer the charges filed against them and requested the harshest punishment in line with Dutch legislation and the rules of international humanitarian laws, also requested compensation for all materiel and moral damage inflicted on the Iraqi people. This is from United Press International. Remarkable. Saddam Hussein suing Bush and Blair. This is going to be treated as a joke in the American media, tragically, because I have to say, I don't think Saddam Hussein necessarily has standing for this lawsuit, although he's probably taking it as, as if he still thinks he's the leader of Iraq, right? But the people of Iraq, I think, have a serious and legitimate beef with how we handled this thing post-invasion, and perhaps even how the invasion was done. And so do some of our vets. We're going to be speaking in a few minutes with Antonino D'Ambrosio, down in Caracas. He's at the World Social Forum. He'll be with us. And he's filming a documentary down there. He sent us some clips from it. Here's Jeffrey Millard of the Iraq Veterans Against the War speaking down in Caracas over the last couple of days about how we can best serve our veterans here in the United States, our Iraq War veterans.
Anyone who's got to support their troops magnet on their car, anyone who believes fully in this Bush hype about support the troops, I invite you to come with me to the VA hospital in Buffalo. I go there all the time. And take a look at what they're living. Take a look at a vet who lives on a thin mattress, which is on top of a piece of plywood, because that's what these vets are living on in VA hospitals, where they're permanently. Go watch a vet die of Gulf War syndrome, and then talk to me about support the troops. Go see the fact that our homeless people in America, which is a huge problem in America, 33% of homeless men are veterans, according to the Department of Defense. These are Department of Defense statistics. So talk to me about support the troops. Go to a VA hospital before you put a magnet on your car. Don't spend the $3 for a kid in China to make you a magnet. Spend the $3 buying a veteran a cup of coffee. Take a veteran at the VA out for a sandwich, because they could use the support.
There you go. Take a vet out for a sandwich. They could use the support. And Bush's idea of support the troops, bring them on. Yeah, and slashing VA budgets. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Joy in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hey, Joy, welcome to the program.
Hello. One thing I called about is, you know, I'm really concerned about this 06 election because I feel like that's the most important election this country's ever had because, you know, Bush is going to take us down to a third world country if we don't get control of at least the Senate. So I hope that, you know, that they could do something about those machines. Because I'm absolutely convinced that Bush did not win either presidential election.
I am too.
I just feel like they hacked into the machines and they took Kerry's votes and turned them into Bush votes. That's what I think.
Is that, Joy, you live in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
Do a lot of Ohioans share your sentiment or is that fairly uncommon?
Well, you know, there's quite a few, but you know, this is really a Republican area. So, mm-hmm. you know, most people, a great many people are for Bush. But
yeah.
Not everybody. Not
no.
everybody. I think less than they were. You know,
yeah.
that's my opinion.
Are the local newspapers and local radio and TV covering the, you know, for example, John Conyers hearings and his
no,
conclusions?
No, I don't see anything. I mean, you know, none of the media, the national, local, or none of the media, I don't see covering anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have the internet, but you know, I go to the library occasionally, but I don't have one. You know.
Yeah.
So my sister tells me some things. You know, so.
So, and you're getting out and talking to your friends, I assume, and saying...
Yeah, because I followed this Bush ever since that 2000 election when I really got into politics. I was kind of following a little bit before because, you know, I was watching when they got ready to do the vote count, and I was so upset when they stopped it, you know, because I just thought that if they'd counted it, that Gore would have won.
Yeah, and when they did count it, in fact, Joy, ultimately in New York, or in Florida, when they did count it, The New York Times reported that Gore actually did win Florida. So, I mean, it's an amazing thing. Joy, thanks so much for the call. It's great to hear from you. I'm sorry, I've got to take a break here right now, but it's great to hear from you, and I wish you the best in waking up the rest of Ohio. We're going to do our part, too. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to West Virginia, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com. And on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. In Caracas, Venezuela, thousands of activists marched through Venezuela's capital demanding an end to the war in Iraq and shouting slogans against U.S. imperialism at the opening of the World Social Forum backed by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, according to Christopher Toothaker in the Associated Press. That's an interesting name. Anyhow, the AP story. Antonino de Ambrosio is an independent journalist and documentary filmmaker based in New York City. He's the founder of La Luta New Media Collective, the website laluta.org, laluta.org. A media activist and documentary production nonprofit. His writing appears in The Nation, The Progressive, Monthly Review, among other publications. His most recent book is Let Fury Have the Hour, The Punk Rock Politics of Joe Strummer. He's at the World Social Forum, filming a documentary on the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, and is speaking with us live from Caracas. Antonino, how are you?
How you doing, Tom? Good to talk to you.
Just great. Good to talk to you again, too. What's happening down there?
Well, there's a lot of things going on. I mean, first and foremost, there's definitely a sense of a strong sense of hopefulness of what's happening here throughout South and Latin America with the current political situation going towards the left and various countries. So the convergence of tens of thousands of people in Caracas has been really pretty thrilling experience in terms of bringing out all these progressive folks around issues such as the one I'm covering of economic justice.
You know, Antonino, I attended during the all of the giant marches against the war in 2002 when everybody was out marching and saying, you know, let's not go into Iraq before the invasion. I was in Seattle visiting, I was doing book tour stuff, and I was visiting Paul Loeb, a friend of mine. And we went to a local church and heard one of the members of the Seattle Congressional, or one of the Washington State Congressional delegation, speak about the war and his opposition to it. And, you know, I mean, there was easily 1,000 people there. It was huge. And, you know, all these people all over the world, this was the world's largest outpouring of people in the history of the planet over any particular issue. And yet Bush still went to war in Iraq. I'm wondering if, in your opinion, you know, 80,000 people showing up in Caracas is going to make any difference.
Well, I think that, you know, you always have to take, you know, I'm looking at it as a, you know, you have to look at the half glass, the glass half full kind of approach for me in terms of, you have to look at the positive effect of it. In terms of, I know that you played a clip from the Iraq war veteran, Jeffrey Millard, who I interviewed down here.
He's
getting a tremendous response, for example, from the people in Venezuela, people converging all around him to ask him why, you know, what's going on, or there are other soldiers that feel like you. And so I think that there is a, you know, it does make a big difference to know that at least Americans on the ground have solidarity with people around the world that are, you know, they share the same views that the war is wrong, that globalization is, you know, killing people, and that imperialism, at least led by the United States, is leading the world really astray.
Antonino, do you Antonino's website, by the way, La Luta, LALUTTA.org. The 80,000 people. What nationalities are making up this mix? What is it like down there? What's your
Well, that's really one of the most amazing parts about it all, is they have this, have the representation from all around the world. We have, you know, people from all parts of Africa, Europe, as far as away as Asia. Of course, we're part of a delegation of 100 folks from the United States, and then, you know, of course, South America is heavily represented. But I think all in all, it's the representation of this. If there's one thing about, if we want to look at globalization, one of the people I've talked to that was a member of Chavez's cabinet is that we're looking to globalize hope and globalize freedom. And I think this kind of convergence of and the diversity of voices kind of really sends a strong message to the United States that there is one barrier to the ill effects of globalization and war and imperialism, and that is, you know, the voice of a diverse, strong people.
Antonino D'Ambrosio is an independent journalist and documentary filmmaker based in New York City. LaLuta.org is website. Antonino, to what extent, I know that this, the timing of this is to be opposite the World Social Forum, which was first held in Brazil in 2001 and is now in Davos, Switzerland, opens Wednesday in Davos, Switzerland. The World Social Forum is balancing the World Economic
That's
Forum.
That's right. That's
yeah,
right.
If I said that right. And to the World Economic Forum is, you know, a bunch of sober political and business leaders sitting down and basically saying, how do we slice and dice the planet?
Right. The
World Social Forum is a little more boisterous and noisy. I'm wondering, though, you get this sense with the World Economic Forum that these are people who really have tremendous power coming together to discuss how to use their power. To what extent at the World Social Forum are leaders of either institutions or nations showing up, or is it mostly simply Mr. Chavez?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that I just left an interview where a high-ranking member of the Brazilian government was here representing Lula, who was unable to attend. And that's the one thing I found, is that in a case like, let's say, we were doing this, something similar like this in the United States, we'd be lucky if, you know, low-level aid would come out at all, if anybody would come out from the government.
Mm-hmm.
Here we're having high-ranking members of governments throughout South America attending, as well as some representatives from France, Germany, Spain, and Italy.
Officially.
Officially. Well, yeah, officially, because those countries have a little bit more openness towards the oppositional aspect. Let's say something I'm very familiar with, the Italian government. While Berlusconi's in power and rules with an iron fist, the opposition has a strong official voice, and that voice is represented here.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, last year, Lula and Chavez were the only two heads of state that showed up. This year, it's just Chavez?
It's just Chavez, and we're going to be meeting with him tomorrow, and we've heard that the new head of state of Chile will be here well tomorrow, which will be wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And the mayor of Mexico, who we hope will be the new president of Mexico soon, we've heard will be here. You know, we've heard some noise on the ground that perhaps the president of Argentina will attend.
Are any, Antonino, are any specific policy programs coming out? I mean, is this more a group of disparate elements with a whole lot of different agendas coming together and saying, you know, there are some things that we're all united against, but, you know, each one
right.
of us has our own, this is what we're for.
Right.
Is there any kind of structure to this? Is there any kind of leadership? Do we expect there to come out of it, you know, the equivalent of the Port Huron statement or something like that?
Right.
You know, or is this more of, you know, hey, it's a party and let's get together and let's share information and let's network and let's create the networks. Yeah, the
right.
infrastructure.
The infrastructure
that,
necessary.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. On my first day here, we were invited to meet one of the founders, organizers of the Social Forum, World Social Forum, Joel Suarez, and that's their objective this year. Their objective is to come out of this with strong policy and strategic, particularly in terms around economic justice and globalization. And their intent is to get it so well organized and have it a strong enough infrastructure that it could be held in the United States in 2007.
Whoa.
Yeah. That's what we said as well.
Yeah.
It's very ambitious, which was very encouraging to us to see that this is not just, let's say, a gathering of people that are going to be dancing, listening to music, and kind of experiencing, you know, another culture, that they're looking to build something that is systemic and expansive and, you know, hopefully will be organizationally sound and strong enough that, for example, that it will be in the United States in 2007.
Well, where do you begin? I mean, is for example, internationalization, the globalization, the World Trade Organization, the surrender of national sovereignty to corporate power, is that the top thing, or is it specifically, for lack of a better word, anti-American? That is to say, you know, pushing back against some of Bush's policies, like the war in Iraq. Where do you think that this is going to begin?
Well, I think that, you know, for me, and maybe I have a little bit of a partial view, partial view on this because I'm here with the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, is that I think it really begins with, you know, the everyday, you know, low-wage worker who throughout the world, they're just getting crushed. And I
is
think
organized labor well represented there?
Labor is pretty well represented, yeah. There are a lot of
labor.
Did the
AFL
leaders.
Or the Coalition for Change send official representatives?
I've seen members of AFL, but no other really big unions. There are members of, you know, there's Unite is here, and then you know, organizers like that are here. Some members unofficially are here from unions I know in New York City, such as the transit workers and people like that, but they're in unofficial capacity. And that's probably due to the nature, you know, not get too involved in this, you know. In New York, we just had a transit strike, and
I know.
So they have to watch what they're doing in terms of, you know, everything now because they rejected the contract that they had when, you know, out on strike about, and so that's a little bit more tenuous for them. But yeah, I think that for what the main objective is really to address, you know, economic justice to not have this. As you know, Thomas Friedman wrote in his book, "The Flattening of the World," which is supposed to be a good thing for your low-wage worker, but it's really, you know, pushing people to farther and farther to the fringes and just crushing people.
Yeah, it's really a disaster. Antonino D'Ambrosio, laluta.org, his website, calling live, speaking with us live from Caracas, Venezuela. Antonino, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Great speaking with you today. And, you know, pass the word along. Say hi to anybody you meet that I might know down there. Peter Werby, my old friend Peter Werby's down there. If you see him, say hi. 45 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. And that's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Tom Hartman here with you.
And what
we're being, the place we're being progressive
today,
never felt so good. The State Department,
today,
now this, the result of the Chicago Tribune, this is why the Fourth Estate is the Fourth Estate, right? I mean, you know, it's not literally accurate. The phrase the Fourth Estate goes back to an old French phrase, but in many regards, the press is thought of as the Fourth Estate with, you know, the three branches of government, and then there's the press to hold them all in check. In fact, Jefferson himself even suggested that that was very much the case, and that we couldn't have an active democracy without an active and independent press. The Chicago Tribune did this research. They broke this story. It was a two-part series called Pipeline to Peril, and as a result of the Chicago Tribune breaking this story, the State Department had to investigate it, and they found some horrible things. This story started out with 12 guys who died, 12 guys from the Kingdom of Nepal who died in Iraq. And what they have unraveled with this thing through the Tribune is that Kellogg Brown and Root and other companies appear to be involved in human trafficking. To quote Cam Simpson in the Chicago Tribune, Pipeline to Peril described how some of KBR's subcontractors and a chain of human brokers stretching to South and Southeast Asia allegedly engaged in the same kinds of abuses routinely condemned in other nations as symptomatic of human trafficking. Newspaper retraced the journey of 12 men recruited from rural villages in Nepal, one of the most remote and impoverished corners of the world. And basically what they found was that these guys, recruiters had come into their villages. These are just absolutely dirt poor places in one of the poorest places in the world, and said, hey, we've got five-star hotels in Amman, Jordan. A very fancy place, Amman, Jordan, a lot of money, you know, very, you know, it's like New York on steroids. I mean, the streets are actually clean. We've got five-star hotels, good jobs, a bellman, as a waiter, as a doorman. I mean, you can make big money. We'll give you a contract. You sign the contract. You actually get the job. You're actually going to get the money. One of these hotels, all you have to do is sign up. And by the way, we have to be paid a recruiting fee. And the recruiting fee is equal to, you know, maybe your first year's wage. And so these people say, or whatever it is. And so these people say, okay, fine. And they pay them up front. Their whole family goes into debt to pay them, to pay the recruiters. And then they put these, then they smuggle these guys out of the country, out of Nepal, and take them to Iraq without their realizing it, and say, okay, now you're in Iraq, you're in a war zone. By the way, you're slave labor now. We're going to pay you one-fifth of what we said we were paying you, and all of it is going to go back to us to pay for the recruiting fees for the next couple of years, and you have no say in it, and if you don't like it, we're just going to kick you out on the street, and good luck with the terrorists. And which is what happened to these 12 guys, and they got rounded up and they got assassinated. Remember the 12 guys from Nepal who got assassinated about 5-6 months ago? That's what started this whole thing. These 12 guys. And this article in the Chicago Tribune, it just, you know, lays the thing out. The Tribune series documented the deaths of the 12 workers. They point out that these folks are being employed directly or indirectly by the U.S. government. That's a phrase from this investigation now done by the State Department into this, at American facilities in Iraq under a multi-billion-dollar privatization contract. That contract, as the Chicago Tribune notes, which has cost taxpayers more than $12 billion, U.S. taxpayers, is held by Halliburton's subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root. A company, I might add, that got reincorporated offshore just in time for these contracts, for the Iraq war to come along, so that they wouldn't have to pay U.S. income taxes. Mind-boggling. The men changed hands at least four times before landing in an unprotected convoy, including deceit, fraud, and coercion for many workers whose families had assumed huge debts to pay fees demanded by brokers in their home countries. Workers felt compelled to head into the war zone or remain in danger for much longer than they desired just to pay the debts. The Tribune also found evidence, this is from the Chicago Tribune, that subcontractors and brokers routinely seized workers' passports, deceived them about their safety or contract terms, and in at least one case allegedly tried to force terrified men into the war zone from a neighboring country under the threat of cutting off their food and water. Now, that's what's happening in the for-profit sector. In the not-for-profit sector, we have Pat Robertson with Operation Blessing, with its 40 paid staff in Virginia Beach. This from the Virginia Pilot, the local paper there, article by Bill Sizemore. Operation Blessing, in the last 2 years, their grants from the federal government have gone from $108,000 to $14.4 million. That, however, is just a small drop in the bucket of the $2 billion in the election year of 2004, which George W. Bush, through presidential initiative, this was not something that was passed by Congress. George W. Bush simply invented this with a stroke of a pen, creating his faith-based initiatives. $2 billion got handed out. $14.4 million of it ended up in the hands of billionaire Pat Robertson. Incredible. Pat Robertson, the billionaire. The article points out that while steering money to religious groups, Bush has tried to starve programs with a proven record of helping low-income families. For example, last month the president supported a House-passed $700 million cut in the food stamp program. So, cut $700 million out of food stamps, give Pat Robertson $14 million to feed people. Meanwhile, hunger in America continues to rise. 7 million people more in food insecure homes, 38 million of them altogether this year than just 5 years ago. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, Brunch with Bernie Sanders tomorrow. Paul Craig Roberts will be here with us to tell us how the new Patriot Act allows you and me to be arrested on the president's whim. That and more, and your calls on the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States. Remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.